Now, when we look up at the night sky, there are plenty of stars to see and trillions of others that we can't. The sheer scale of the universe can be overwhelming, but by zeroing in on a star here and a nebula there, astronomers have spent the past few thousand years getting a better idea of how space works and where we are in it. Our next guest turns his lens to some of the most famous stars and how they've provided the key for answering big questions about the universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a stargazer? Do you have a favorite star or maybe one that helps guide you when you look at the night sky? What interests you the most about the different types of stars we can see? And what questions do you have about how we know what we know about stars, what they're made of, where they are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Giles Sparrow is a science writer whose latest book is A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and 3 Imposters. Giles, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Vope. Thanks for having me.
Well, trillions of stars out there, as I said. How did you narrow it down to pick the stars of your book?
Well, it's although there's like there's about 200 billion stars in the Milky Way and about 200 billion galaxies in the universe that we can see. But we're kind of lucky that they kind of fall into categories. So you can, one star can stand for an awful lot of them. And the stars pass through various different stages in their lives. And depending on how much material they've got inside them, they can evolve down different pathways. But I looked at this, I've had this idea of doing a book like this for many years. And I kind of thought, okay, how many can I boil it down to? And that's where I kind of came up with the figure of 21 from. And I thought, okay, well, now I need to find like the best representatives of these different stars and ideally ones that you can see in the night sky without any special equipment, just with the naked eye or with binoculars.
And part of what I love about the book is that the stars you picked don't just tell their own story, but also the story about how we here on Earth started to learn more about stars, what they were, and how far away they were. And let's start there with the star 61 Cygni, or do I say 61 Cygni? I don't know.
I say 61.
61, me too. Great. How that one helped us figure out how far away stars were, because that was a wide open question for millennia.
Well, it was, yeah. It was one of the things when they first figured out that the Earth must be orbiting around the sun, one of the arguments that people used to push back against it was, well, if the Earth is moving around the sun instead of staying still in the middle of the universe, then why don't we see the star? Why doesn't our point of view of the stars change from like one half of the year to the other? Because if you think, if we're moving hundreds of millions of miles from one side of our orbit around the sun to the other, then you'd kind of expect that our point of view of the stars would shift. And just the same as if you kind of hold your finger out at the end of your arm and then squint at it through one eye and then the other, it seems to move against the background. And so they eventually, you know, people said, well, it must be because the stars are even further away than we can imagine. So we don't see these, you know, we don't see these shifts, but they're there. And it took a long time for them to figure this out, a couple of hundred years. So people kept on trying and failing to find it until like the 1830s or so. And eventually they worked out, there was this star 61 Cygni, which is in the constellation of the Swan, which is a summer, you can see it on summer nights, not so much at this time of year. But it's not a particularly significant star. But one thing they had noticed about it was that it moves across the sky quite rapidly. And all the stars obviously drift across the sky in the course of the night as the Earth rotates underneath them. But some stars actually move in relation to the other stars very gradually. But this one, in comparison to a lot of the others, it was moving at a tremendous pace. And when I say that, it's like only covering the width of a full moon every few hundred years. But that was enough for them to call it the flying star. And they figured, well, if that one appears to be moving so fast, then maybe it's really close to us. And so they eventually managed to measure the view, measure what angle it was at from when they looked at it from Earth on one side of its orbit and on the other side. And they got this tiny little shift in the angle that they could see. And from that, it's fairly straightforward maths, because you know the distance from one side of Earth's orbit to the other, to then work out exactly how far it is, how far away it is. And it turned out to be just over 10 light years away, which means that based on its brightness, it's a star, or a pair of stars, in fact, that are about half the brightness of the sun. But this was really the first hint or confirmation that other stars really were other suns, fairly like our own.
Talking to Giles Sparrow about his new book, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and 3 Imposters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you are a backyard stargazer with the naked eye, binoculars, telescopes, you name it. Tell us what you like to look for at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. One thing that kind of blows my mind, Giles, and this comes up a few times through the book, we look back at the ancient Greeks, for example, and their observations. Their night sky might have been different than our night sky because the tilt of the Earth has changed. So things that they might have been able to see things now that only the southern hemisphere could see nowadays.
Yes, it's one of these funny effects that most people know that the north, the pole star Polaris, sits directly in line with Earth's north pole. And so it's the one star that doesn't move through the night. And that's because although Earth's axis is tilted compared to like straight up in the sky by about 23 degrees, and that stays pointing at the same general direction in space towards Polaris all the way through the year as the Earth orbits the sun. It kind of spins around, but it doesn't change the orientation of the poles. So that's what gives us the seasons. But because the moon's it's actually due to the moon's gravity tugging slightly at Earth's equator, the direction that the pole points in does change very, very slowly over about 26,000 years. And that means that the direction of the star that's the center point of the sky, as it were, the pivot point, that tracks around over 26,000 years. And sometimes it's just pointing at empty space. In a few thousand years' time, it'll be pointing at a star called Vega, which is one of the brightest stars in the sky. It's in the constellation of Lyra. And so that changes. And because the range of other stars that you can see and how far south in the sky you can see is related to where this central pivot point is, that brings other stars into view at different times.
Let's talk about another star you feature here. Now, we can look and we can see the stars even from the ground here. We can see they have different colors, different levels of brightness. And that could tell us a lot. It was a big part of the birth of astrophysics. One star you focus on is Aldebaran in the Taurus constellation. How does that fit into the story?
Yeah, it's that's a really bright one. It's an easy one to spot. If you go out anytime around now and have a clear night, you can see the constellation of the Bull Taurus will be in the southwest after sunset. And it's pretty prominent because it's got this V-shaped face. There's a star cluster called the Hyades. And Aldebaran is the brightest star in that cluster or in front of that cluster. And it makes the eye of the Bull. And it was the first star where they really analyzed its light by splitting it through a device. It's called a diffraction grating, but basically it works the same as a prism, a glass prism. So it splits up light into all of its different colors according to the wavelength and the energy that the light contains. And so this was the very first star that they tried this with. They'd done it with the sun. A guy called Josef von Fraunhofer did that in the early 1800s. But it was it wasn't until the 1860s that they really had the technology and telescopes had come on enough to get this to work. And they found that there were these dark lines across the face. When you spread out the light, it's a red star, so you find that there's a lot of red light and some yellow lights and some whitish, you know, light in the middle, but not much sort of blue light or hotter, higher temperatures. And but the colors have got these dark lines in front of them, which is, they figured out, is where different chemicals that are in the star's atmosphere are absorbing the energy at specific wavelengths, because every chemical has its fingerprints, if you like, that it's a particular types of light that it gives out or absorbs depending based on its atomic structure. And that's like a unique print that you can use to trace the chemicals in the atmospheres of stars. And Aldebaran was the very first one that they did it on. They went on to do it on millions and millions of others.
We're talking to author Giles Sparrow about his new book, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and Three Imposters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the night sky? If you are a stargazer yourself, tell us about what you do, where you go to do it. Do you have a favorite star or one that you use to find your way in the night sky? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Giles Sparrow, author of the book, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and Three Imposters. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Rhinelander. John, hi.
I worked for the science laboratory of GE Medical for 5 years, and we would call that machine a spectroscoper to sort out the different light waves of different atoms. I have a question and a comment for your guest. How many times hotter is the sun than it takes to melt steel? And a comment is, if we can see so many galaxies by our naked eye, how many can we see with a telescope?
Wow. Okay, John, you gave us a lot to work with there. Giles, the heat of suns, of stars, well, it depends on the star, I guess, but more than hot enough to melt steel, I should think.
Oh, yes, definitely. And the sun's temperature is about 10,000 Fahrenheit, roughly. Thinking, I'm having to convert, being a Brit, I kind of think in Celsius most of the time.
Fair enough.
But I think the melting point of like carbon steel is about 2,700 Fahrenheit or so. So I guess the sun's, at a crude guess, you know, the sun is about four times hotter than the temperature it takes to melt steel. And and the sun is quite average, you know, for a star in terms of its temperature. You can get stars that have got temperatures of up to, you know, 80,000 Fahrenheit or so, some of the really hot blue and, you know, blue-white ones.
And then John asked about galaxies, and that's one of your three imposters in the book, the Andromeda galaxy, which people thought, is it a star? Is it a nebula? So how many galaxies like that can we see just, you know, on a clear night in an unlit area versus how many we're picking up, maybe with just a backyard telescope? I know an orbital telescope can get a lot more.
Yes. Yeah. On a clear night, you can see, I think if you really push the limits of what you're, you know, I've heard reports of people being able to see maybe three or four of the nearby spiral galaxies. Andromeda is very definitely the only one that you can see quite prominently with the naked eye. It's kind of a middle, it looks like a middle ranking fuzzy star if you know where to look for it. And when you look through binoculars or something like that, you see it's this kind of lens shaped glowing ball of light. And if you're in the southern hemisphere, you can see the two patches called the Magellanic Clouds, which look like outlined bits of the Milky Way, but are actually other galaxies that are in orbit around ours, but they're much smaller. And there's only really another couple of spirals where I've ever heard reports of people seeing them with their naked eyes. So it's really a handful. But on the other hand, that means if you look at Andromeda, you're looking at something, the light that's hitting the back of your eyeball is stuff that it left 2.5 million years ago and has traveled all the way across space to kind of be with us tonight. So it's quite a journey it's taken.
And one of the amazing things to me, Giles, is we've really only known about this whole galaxy thing for, what, about 100 years now?
Yes, yeah. It was, and there was quite a fierce debate before that. People were wondering, okay, is the Milky Way and the star, you know, all the stars and things, because everything we can see is, we now think of as part of our own, you know, as all the stars in the sky are really belong in our own galaxy. And people debated whether or not that was the full extent of it, and they wondered what these other fuzzy objects in the sky were. And then eventually, using the spectroscope, as your caller had the right terminology, they they worked out that some of them were made of gas, and so mostly they shone like a neon lamp, and other ones appeared to be made up of countless stars. So they then started wondering, okay, are these things that are quite nearby in orbit around the Milky Way, or are they immensely distant, and are they island universes, was the term that they liked to use at the time to describe what might be other galaxies. And and eventually a very clever lady called Henrietta Swan Leavitt came up with a method for measuring the distance of stars that would actually work even when you're looking at these vast distances of intergalactic space, because she figured out that there's a certain group of variable stars, which are stars that pulsate in light. They give out more light at some times and less at others, and they kind of pulsate over a few days, roughly. And she worked out there was a link between the rate at which these things pulsated and their intrinsic brightness, the actual how fiercely the star was burning. And so once she knew that, another chap, Edwin Hubble, after whom the telescope is named, then took that discovery, and he very carefully looked at the Andromeda galaxy and photographed it, you know, continuously, and eventually was able to track down that there were some of these pulsating stars there. And so he painstakingly measured the time that they were taking to change and how long the period of variation was. And from that, he was able to work out, okay, if these are Cepheids, the same as the ones that Henrietta Leavitt had discovered in and around the Milky Way, then they must be a certain luminosity. And given how faint they appear from Earth, they would have to be 2 million or more light years away.
Thanks for that call. We'll bring on Kimberly now in Fox Lake. Kimberly, hi.
Hi. So one of my favorite stars has always been Betelgeuse, and I'm not sure if you covered it in your book, but I didn't know if you knew much about that or had any interesting facts about that star.
Kimberly, thanks for the call. Giles, you do. It is one of your 21 stars. We just have a couple minutes left. Give us a little bit about Betelgeuse.
I do indeed, yeah. Betelgeuse is amazing. It's a red giant star. It's on the shoulder of Orion, the constellation of the Hunter, which, again, you can see at this time of year. Go out and you'll see he kind of stands there, and he's facing off against Taurus, the bull. So he's quite prominent, and Betelgeuse is a red supergiant. It's a dying star that's got a lot more mass than the sun, and due to instability inside, most stars through their lives, they shine by burning hydrogen in their cores and turning that into helium. But as they get older, they run out of hydrogen, and they go to increasingly desperate measures to keep on shining by burning heavier and heavier elements, and this makes the star unstable, and so it brightens up, but it also balloons enormously in size, and so that actually cuts down the amount of energy that's heating up any particular part of the surface, and so that's why they appear red. And yeah, it's one of the few stars that we've been able to actually measure. If you've got a powerful enough telescope, you can Yeah, and I'm talking about space telescopes here. It's one of the few stars that you can actually see that it's something other than a single point of light in the sky, because it's that immense that you can actually detect its extended atmosphere around it.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Giles, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to science writer Giles Sparrow. His latest book is called A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and 3 Impostors.